As only a lover of magnificence, as the first host in history to offer his guests a selection of 4 fine wines, can be. He dispatched agents to confiscate delicacies in the market, to confiscate ornate tableware, mid-meal, in private homes. With few exceptions, he prohibited litters, scarlet garments, pearls. To anyone accustomed to Alexandria, the fashion capital of the world, the idea that Caesar's Rome needed sumptuary laws was laughable. A woman who knew when it was time to downgrade her dinnerware could be trusted to dress appropriately, however. Cleopatra may have toned down the wardrobe. A Roman matron wore white, where the Alexandrian woman relished color. And a woman who could calibrate her humor for different audiences knew better than to scorn a dinner that in no way rivaled her fare at home. As has been observed over the millennia, luxury is more easily denounced than denied. Caesar's edict was more popular with some than others. It won few points from Cicero, who weaned himself with difficulty that winter from peacock, giant oysters, and saltwater eel. Peacock meat was notoriously tough, but that was not the point. Oysters and eels, Cicero moaned, had never offended his digestive system, as did turnips. What Cleopatra thought of the Puritans, real and purported, among whom she found herself, we do not know. We know well what they thought of her. Marriage and women were done differently in Rome, where female authority was a meaningless concept. Similarly, for a man to be called effeminate was the worst insult. The Roman definition of a good woman was an inconspicuous woman, something that defied Cleopatra's training. In Alexandria, she needed to make a spectacle of herself. Here, the mandate was reversed. Not only was a Roman woman without political or legal rights, but she was without a personal name. She carried only the one derived from her father. Caesar had 2 sisters, both named Julia. Roman women cast their eyes down in public, where they were silent and recessive. They did not issue the dinner invitations. They were invisible in intellectual life, represented less often in art than they were in Egypt, where female workers and female pharaohs appear in painting and sculpture, in tomb scenes and on chapel walls, trapping birds, selling goods, or making offerings to the gods. For a foreign sovereign, the rules, like the sumptuary laws, did not entirely apply. But Cleopatra could not have felt at her ease. Footnote: the prevailing ethos is preserved in the literature. In the Iliad, women are the most perfect things in creation. They are also, as has been observed, as a general rule, teasing, scolding, thwarting, contradicting, and hoodwinking. In the Greek plays, women have the key parts. There are few outsized female heroines in Roman literature, in which wives come in 2 varieties, the tyrannical rich and the spendthrift poor. Roman literature is notably short as well on deceived husbands, a comic staple from Aristophanes to Molière. End of footnote. As always, what kept women pure was the drudge's life. Juvenal supplied the traditional formula. Hard work, short sleep, hands chafed and hardened from housework. As a marriage crasher who had somehow hustled herself into Venus's exalted company, Cleopatra unsettled Rome on any number of counts. She was female and foreign, an Eastern monarch in what still believed itself to be a king-crushing republic, a stand-in for Isis, whose cult was suspect and subversive, and whose temples were notorious spots for assignations. Cleopatra confused the categories and flouted convention. Even by modern standards, she posed problems of protocol. If she was the mistress of a Roman dictator, was she the mistress of the Roman world as well? No matter how she comported herself, at all times she seemed to have been as deft with her image as her person, she broke every rule in the book. A queen at home, she was a courtesan out of her country. And she was something more dangerous still, a courtesan with means. Cleopatra was not merely economically independent, but richer than any man in Rome. Her very wealth, the same wealth that had fed Rome during the triumphs, impugned her morals. To wax eloquent on someone's embossed silver, his sumptuous carpets, his marble statuary, was to indict him. The implications were greater for the lesser sex. There's nothing a woman doesn't allow herself, nothing she considers disgusting, once she has put an emerald choker around her neck and has fastened giant pearls to her elongated ears, went the logic. In that respect, the length of her ears would do more to seal Cleopatra's fate than that of her nose. Footnote. As Blaise Pascal asserted in the 17th century, had Cleopatra's nose been shorter, the whole face of the world would have been changed. End of footnote. Even assuming she had left her best jewelry in Alexandria, she was synonymous in Rome with the reckless extravagance of that world. It was no less than her birthright. A proper Roman woman considered her children her jewels. By Roman standards, even Cleopatra's eunuchs were rich. This meant that every unpardonable evil in the profligacy family attached itself to her. Well before she became the sorceress of legend, a reckless, careless destroyer of men, she was suspect as an extravagant Easterner, a reckless, careless destroyer of wealth. If moral turpitude began with shellfish and metastasized into purple and scarlet robes, it found its ostentatious apogee in pearls, which topped the extravagance scale in Rome. Suetonius invoked them to prove Caesar's weakness for luxury. The story of the libertine who sacrificed a pearl to make his point was an oft-told tale on the books long before 46 and fated to stay there to indict others long after. It seemed, however, tailor-made for an audacious Egyptian queen. There are signs of confabulation as well as conflation here. Within a matter of years, Cleopatra was said to have worn the two pearls that were the largest in the whole of history. Pliny assigned each a value of 420 talents, which meant Cleopatra dangled the equivalent of a Mediterranean villa from each ear. The sum was the same that she had contributed to the burial of the Memphis bull. Who else could have been so frivolous, so wanton, so ready to enchant a man, that she would pluck a pearl from her lobe, dissolve it in vinegar, and swallow it, to beguile a man with magic and excess? Footnote. Many have marveled at the tale, but only one man has sacrificed Tiffany pearls to a laboratory investigation of it. Does a pearl actually disintegrate in vinegar? Yes, if very slowly, reported B.L. Ullman, who in the end resorted to heat to nudge his 1956 experiment along. When I boiled a pearl for 33 minutes, the vinegar boiled off while I was reading a detective story. I can still smell that vinegar. The pearl seemed not to be affected, though I thought it looked a trifle peaked. He got better results with stronger vinegar, the best results with pulverized pearl, which dissolved after 3 hours and 20 minutes of closely monitored boiling. This is the kind of thing to which Cleopatra has driven scholars. To the question of why Cleopatra, or anyone, might have attempted such a display in the first place, surely it made more dramatic sense to swallow the gem whole. Ullman reminds us that pearls consist primarily of carbonate of lime, the ancient world's bicarbonate of soda. They make an effective, if expensive, antacid. End of footnote. Such was the story that would circulate later about Cleopatra. Neither the magic nor the excess was likely to have been much on display over the winter of 46. Cleopatra clearly frequented some fashionable addresses, though it was difficult to believe she was not often at home in Caesar's villa, surrounded solely by her advisers and retainers. Some of those courtiers knew their way around Rome, having lobbied for her father's notorious restoration. She lived these months in Latin. Whatever her proficiency in that language, she discovered that certain concepts did not translate. Even the sense of humor was different, broad and salty in Rome, where it was ironic and elusive in Alexandria. Literal-minded, the Romans took themselves seriously. Alexandrian irreverence and exuberance were in scant supply. When spring rolled around and the sea reopened, Cleopatra may have sailed home to return to Rome later in the year. Two consecutive visits seem more likely than a single extended one. She could hardly have justified an 18-month absence, no matter how confident she felt of her authority in Egypt. That would have entailed a grueling amount of travel, though the southbound trip was a less taxing one. Assuming she returned to Alexandria in 45, she set out in late March or early April, by which time the northeasterly squalls had abated, the thunder and lightning off the coast of Egypt with them. One did not brave the gales in winter. One did so only with trepidation in the spring, once the leaves at the top of the fig tree are as big as the footprint a crow leaves as it goes. If Cleopatra indeed sailed home early in 45, she was again in Rome by the fall. Only an interim return to Alexandria makes sense of Suetonius's account, in which Caesar saw Cleopatra off from Rome. He would not have a second opportunity to do so. To Suetonius, working from a broad collection of sources, if over a century and a half later, the parting was as reluctant as the about-face on the Nile. The Roman commander did not let her leave until he had laden her with high honors and rich gifts. He acknowledged Caesarion as his son and allowed her to give his name to the child. There was no reason for him to hesitate to do so. At least in 45, Caesar's plans could only be furthered by an Eastern heir and a living link to Alexander the Great. He was also conceding the obvious. If he had not already begun to do so, 2-year-old Caesarion soon enough resembled his father in looks and manner. The acknowledgement may have been the point of the reunion. Caesarion's recognition was easily worth any number of trips across the Mediterranean. As one historian has it, and as many have noted under similar circumstances before and since, their child was her best card if she aimed at pinning Caesar down to a previous agreement or promise. The nature of that promise eludes us, aside from formal recognition as a friend of Rome, which had cost Cleopatra's father the astounding sum of 6,000 talents. How else to account for the extended Roman stay, or stays? There was too much at stake to subscribe to sentiment over politics. Caesar had summoned Cleopatra once before. His own motives over these 18 months are among the most probed and least understood in history. It is plausible that the two were planning some kind of future together, as many would conclude, to Caesar's discredit. At the end of her life, Cleopatra had in hand a clutch of passionate, admiring letters from Caesar, at least some of which he must have written to her between 48 and 46. Here was the historical version of that beautiful vase of poisonous snakes. It is possible that Cleopatra felt she needed to press her case personally with Caesar's colleagues to confirm that Egypt was to remain a friend and ally of Rome under her rule. The Senate was a less than cohesive body, invested in private agendas, and by no means unanimously inclined toward Caesar's. She knew intimately of its factions. To broaden her base of support abroad was to secure the throne at home. Cicero's take on official Rome was less flattering. A more raffish assemblage never sat down in a low-grade music hall, he huffed about a jury of his peers. Cleopatra's second visit would have coincided with Caesar's autumn return from Spain in 45, by which time he expected to turn to a reorganization of the East. She could not afford to be left out of that conversation, if only for the sake of Cyprus, which formerly belonged to her brother and which had a tendency to resist her authority. If Cleopatra had greater plans still, they are lost to us today. Certainly it was easy to assign her spectacular designing motives. Rome was accustomed to scheming Ptolemies. What survives instead is the cost of Cleopatra's reunion with Caesar. It was ruinous. While she may have spent her days as quietly as Homer's Penelope, she wound up more like a calamity-causing Helen of Troy. This was to be her illogical adventure. Chapter 5. Man is by nature a political creature. Oh, would that the female sex were nowhere to be found, but in my lap. Euripides. I don't know how a man of any sense can be happy at the present time, Cicero had grumbled shortly before Cleopatra first set foot in Rome. After an appalling decade of war, the mood in Rome was sour. That of Cicero, its most prominent citizen, and the most articulate of its discontents, even more so. For some months, the city had been in a state of general perturbation and chaos, as Cleopatra was well aware. Her intelligence would have been detailed. She and her courtiers enjoyed contacts at high levels of society. She could afford to neglect no feature of the political landscape. Throughout town, anxiety about the future was universal. Caesar's civic reforms were promising, but how and when would he put the Republic back together again? Over years of war, it had been turned upside down, the Constitution trampled, appointments made on whim and against the law. Caesar took few steps toward restoring traditional rights and regulations. Meanwhile, his powers expanded. He took charge of most elections and decided most court cases. He spent a great deal of time settling scores, rewarding supporters, auctioning off his opponents' properties. The Senate appeared increasingly irrelevant. Some groused that they lived in a monarchy masquerading as a republic. There were three possibilities for the future, predicted an exasperated Cicero. Endless armed conflict, eventual revival after a peace, and complete annihilation. When Caesar returned from Spain that fall, he had annihilated the surviving Pompeians. The civil war was, Caesar announced, finally over. He settled in Rome for what was to be his longest uninterrupted stay in 14 years. Whether it was conducted circumspectly or not, he and Cleopatra continued their affair. To many, her reasons for being in Rome may have been as opaque as they are to us. She had experience with unpopularity. It would have come in handy now. She lived at a less than desirable address, on a slippery grade between superiority and slight. At the same time, it is impossible to believe that she failed to elicit brisk curiosity, if not starry-eyed admiration. She presumably continued her father's generous gift-giving tradition. He had handed out lavish bribes and incurred great debts, equally fine reasons to seek out his daughter. She was intellectually agile, which always impressed Romans. Fashion paused to acknowledge her presence. Cleopatra set off a brief vogue for an elaborate hairstyle in which rows of braids were knotted cornrow style and caught in a bun behind the head. Rome was, moreover, a stratified, status-obsessed society. Rank mattered, learning mattered, money mattered. Cleopatra was a member of the elite, to whom the social mores were familiar. So far as the conversation went, a sophisticated Roman dinner was little different from a sophisticated Alexandrian dinner. A subtle and clever guest, Cleopatra would have warmed to the political gossip and to the kind of learned, leisurely discourse prized in Rome. the brand of talk that was said to improve the wine. In the definition of an erudite contemporary, the ideal dinner companion was neither a chatterbox nor a mute. Over the course of several late afternoon hours, he discoursed fluently on a variety of political, scientific, and artistic subjects, taking aim at the eternal questions. What came first, the chicken or the egg? Why does distance vision improve with age? Why do Jews shun pork? Cleopatra had Caesar's favor. She could not have been friendless. For his part, Caesar paid no heed to the tongues that wagged over her presence. He was not at all concerned, however, about this, Dio assures us. At Caesar's villa, she was surrounded by distinguished intellectuals and seasoned diplomats. She was refined, generous, charismatic. Some impressions may well have been favorable. We are left, however, with the testimony of a sole witness, at once the most silver and acid-tongued of Romans, who, it was noted, could always be counted on for a great deal of barking. "I detest the queen," railed Cicero. History belongs to the eloquent. The great orator was at the time of Cleopatra's visit a gray and grizzled 60-year-old monument of a man, still handsome, the even features melting into jowls. In the thick of a furious writing spree, Cicero devoted himself over Cleopatra's time in Rome to the composition of a host of wide-ranging philosophical works. He had, the previous year, divorced his wife of 3 decades to marry his wealthy teenaged ward, for which exchange he offered up reasons similar to those that had brought Cleopatra to Rome in the first place. "I knew no security, had no refuge from intrigue, because of the villainy of those to whom my welfare and estate should have been most precious." To his mind, the solution was obvious. "Therefore, I thought it advisable to fortify myself by the loyalty of new connections against the treachery of old ones." In other words, Cicero, a self-made man from a provincial family who had risen to prominence on his blazing intellectual gifts and maintained his place there by ceaseless politicking, remarried for money. It is no more surprising that Cicero called on Cleopatra in the first place than it is that he came to lash her with a quick and brutal tongue for the ages. Generally, the great Cicero had 2 modes, fawning and captious. He could apply both equally well to the same individual. He was perfectly capable of maligning a man one day and swearing eternal devotion to him the next. He was a great writer, which is to say, self-absorbed, with an outsize ego and a fanatical sensitivity to slights real and imagined. The Roman John Adams, he lived his life with one eye always on posterity. He fully expected that we would be reading him 2,000 years later. As accomplished a busybody as he was a master of eloquence, Cicero made it his mission to know precisely which lands every eminent man in Rome possessed, as well as where he lived and what company he frequented. Having stood at the center stage of Roman politics for 3 decades, he refused to be sidelined. He was irresistibly drawn to power and fame. No celebrity was going to escape his caustic clutches, especially one with an intellectual bent, a glamorous international reputation, the resources to raise an army, and a habit of entertaining in a style that taxed the Roman vocabulary. The turnips sickened Cicero on several levels. He was a confirmed lover of luxury. In the misunderstanding that seemed to seal her Roman fate, Cleopatra promised Cicero either a book or a manuscript, possibly one from her library in Alexandria. In any event, she failed to deliver. Plainly, she had no regard for his feelings. Those were further frayed when her emissary turned up at Cicero's home. Cleopatra's man wanted not Cicero, but Cicero's highly learned best friend. There is some murkiness here. 2,000 years later, we are also left parsing the great orator's silences. But from Cicero's deep ellipses and dark hints emerges a man less offended than embarrassed. Suddenly, he felt on the defensive, chagrined either that he had asked a service of Cleopatra or that he had socialized with her in the first place. He sounds as if he may have been a little too charmed. To that friend, he labored to make clear that his intercourse with the queen was of a literary kind, not unbecoming to my position. I should not mind telling them to a public meeting. Nothing untoward had transpired. Cleopatra's representative could back him up on this. Cicero's dignity had, however, been compromised. The result was a blistering rancor. He wanted nothing more to do with the Egyptian. What could she and her representatives have been thinking? Few have paid such a lasting price for a forgotten book. For her oversight, Cleopatra earned Cicero's eternal enmity, though it should be noted that he worked himself up into a lather of indignation only after she had departed from Rome, to which she was unlikely to return. And despite his disaffection, he had clearly frequented the Egyptian queen, in society, if not at Caesar's villa, a statement in itself. Bibliographic slights aside, there were plenty of reasons why Cicero should have failed to take to Cleopatra. An unreconstructed Pompeian, he had no affection for Caesar, who condescended to Cicero and failed sufficiently to appreciate his wisdoms. Cicero had had harsh words for Cleopatra's father. He had known Auletes and thought him a poor excuse for a king. He dismissed his Alexandrian majesty as royal in neither blood nor spirit. A dyed-in-the-wool republican, Cicero had already devoted more time than he would have liked to Egyptian affairs. They had about them always a whiff of dishonor. He had, in Cleopatra's youth, hoped to be named envoy to her father's court, but worried about how history and respectable Rome might view that posting. Cicero had, as well, a vexed history with women. He had long complained that his first wife had too much taste for public affairs and too little for domestic ones. Having just rid himself of one strong-minded, strong-willed woman, he had no taste for another. By contrast, he was passionately, deeply devoted to his daughter, on whom he had lavished a first-rate education. She died suddenly in childbirth in February 45. She was not yet 30. Cicero spent the subsequent months crippled by grief. The pain was nearly physical. He was prone to fits of weeping, which friends gently urged him to restrain. Footnote. He was unapologetic, the more so as he was in the midst of his grief feverishly productive. He defied those happy souls who begrudged him his mourning to so much as read half the pages that he, in his misery, had written. End of footnote. The loss did nothing to endear to him another cultured and cool-headed young woman of his daughter's generation, her future before her. When his new teenaged wife proved insufficiently moved by his loss, Cicero got rid of her too, within months of the marriage. The arrogance of the queen herself when she was living on the estate across the Tiber makes my blood boil to recall, Cicero fumed in mid-44. On that count, he had met his match. He admitted to a certain foolish vanity to which I am somewhat prone. Writing later, Plutarch was more explicit on the subject. Brilliant though he was, quotable though he was, Cicero was so keen on extolling himself as to be nauseating. He larded his works with shameless self-advertisements. Dio does not mince words either regarding Cicero. He was the greatest boaster alive. The vanity extended most of all to his library, arguably the real love of Cicero's life. It is difficult to name anything in which he took more pleasure, aside possibly from evasion of the sumptuary laws. Cicero liked to believe himself wealthy. He prided himself on his books. He needed no further reason to dislike Cleopatra. Intelligent women who had better libraries than he did offended him on 3 counts. Cicero denounced Cleopatra for her insolence, though it should be said that insolent was quite possibly his favorite word. Caesar was insolent. Pompey had been insolent. Caesar's trusted associate, Mark Antony, for whom Cicero had many far less kind expressions, was insolent. Alexandrians were insolent. Victory in a civil war was insolent. Cicero was accustomed to being the most articulate person in the room. It was annoying that Cleopatra shared his sardonic wit. And was it really necessary for her to act regally? He sniffed that she comported herself like a queen, an offense to his republican sensibilities, no doubt all the more so for his undistinguished birth. Here he had a point. He was not the last to note Cleopatra's high-handedness. Strategy came more naturally to her than did diplomacy. She may have been tactless. Megalomania ran in the family. She had no trouble reminding those around her that, as she would assert later, she had for many years governed a vast kingdom by herself. Disdain is a natural condition of the mind in exile. Cleopatra had every reason to believe she hailed from a superior world. No one in Rome had a pedigree to rival hers. It bothered Cicero that she seemed to know as much. Around the proud queen and the disconsolate philosopher, the political situation meanwhile darkened. Caesar was preoccupied by military matters, little focused on the long-neglected issues toward which others urged him. The to-do list staggered. He needed to repair the courts, curtail spending, restore credit, resurrect the work ethic, welcome new citizens, improve public morality, elevate freedom over glory. In short, rescue almost from the brink of ruin the most famous and powerful of cities. Along with everyone else, Cicero found himself parsing Caesar's motives, as thankless a task in 45 as it has proved ever since. At the end of the year, a host of honors was heaped upon Caesar, essentially deifying him in the style of a Hellenistic monarch. Over the next months, his statue was erected in temples. An ivory facsimile of his image graced processions, as would a god's. His power swelled to awkward dimensions. Cicero would be only too happy to catalog the offenses later. In the meantime, he preened over his visits with the great general. There was much grumbling about manner. During Cleopatra's stay, Caesar comported himself as the man who had won 302 battles, who had fought the Gauls no fewer than 30 times, who was impossible to terrify and was victorious at the end of every campaign. On the other hand, he was ill-inclined to compromise. He ignored tradition. He behaved too much like a military commander, too little like a politician. The flames of discontent broke out regularly, ably fanned by Cicero and any number of other ex-Pompeians. In February 44, Caesar was named dictator for life. Further privileges rained down on him. He was to wear triumphal dress and to occupy a raised ivory and gold chair, suspiciously like a throne. His image was to grace Roman coins, a first for a living Roman. Resentment accumulated in equal measure, although it was the Senate itself that encouraged him and puffed him up, only to find fault with him on this very account and to spread slanderous reports how glad he was to accept them and how he behaved more haughtily as a result of them. Caesar perhaps erred in accepting the tributes, but was also in something of a bind. To reject them was to risk offending. it is difficult to say which expanded to meet the other, the superhuman ego or the superhuman honors under the weight of which Caesar would finally be buried. To complicate matters, Caesar busied himself that winter with a new and supremely ambitious campaign, one that promised to leave Rome again in the lurch. He set his sights on the conquest of Parthia, a nation that stood at Rome's eastern frontier and that had long resisted its hegemony. The prospect was one guaranteed later to make Cleopatra groan, if it did not do so already. Though in disintegrating health and a fatalistic frame of mind, Caesar planned to clear Rome's way to India. He was 55 years old, intent on a mission that would consume at least 3 years. It was the one at which Alexander the Great had nearly succeeded. Cicero doubted that Caesar would return were he actually to head off. In the spring of 44, he sent 16 legions and a sizable cavalry ahead to Parthia, announcing a departure date of March 18th. He made arrangements for his absence. Presumably Cleopatra did too, and began to pack. But fears and doubts ricocheted around town. When would domestic issues be resolved? How would Rome survive without Caesar? That concern was legitimate, given the mixed performance Mark Antony had turned in during Caesar's time in Egypt. His appointed deputy, Antony, had been unreliable and ineffective. He had established a reputation for profligacy. For those who wondered primarily when Caesar would restore the Republic, an oracle of the winter was particularly unwelcome. A prophecy either materialized or was said to, asserting that Parthia could be conquered only by a king. Word had it that the title was to be conferred imminently on Caesar. That may have been little more than a rumor. Oracles were nothing if not convenient. But it spoke to the thorny question of why Cleopatra was living in Caesar's villa in the first place. Caesar may have had monarchical ambitions, or he may not have. Certainly, he was carelessly out of touch with Rome, less focused on domestic affairs than was wise, autocratic where he should have been solicitous. If one prefers not to be perceived as a king, one is ill-advised, for starters, to spend one's time consorting with a queen. Until 44 BC, the Ides of March were best known as a springtime frolic, an occasion for serious drinking like so many others on the Roman calendar. A celebration of the ancient goddess of ends and beginnings, the Ides amounted to a sort of raucous, reeling New Year's. Bands of revelers picnicked into the night along the banks of the Tiber, where they camped in makeshift huts under a full moon. It was a festival, often indelibly recalled 9 months later. In 44, the day dawned overcast. Toward the end of the cloudy morning, Caesar set off by litter for the Senate to finalize arrangements for his absence. The young and distinguished Publius Cornelius Dolabella hoped to be named consul in his place, as did Mark Antony, Dolabella's rival in Caesar's affections. The Senate assembled that day in one of the large chambers adjoining Pompey's Theater. All rose as Caesar entered, a laurel wreath on his head. At about 11 o'clock, he settled into his new golden chair. He was quickly surrounded by colleagues, many of them devoted friends. One extended a petition which occasioned a flurry of importuning and kissing of hands. Caesar moved to dismiss the request, at which his petitioner, interrupting him in mid-sentence, reached out to yank Caesar's toga roughly from his shoulder. It was the predetermined signal. With it, the group closed in, bearing daggers. Caesar twisted away from the initial knife, which only grazed him, but found himself powerless against the rain of blows that followed. Every conspirator had agreed to participate in the attack, and did so, stabbing wildly at Caesar's face, his thighs, his chest, and occasionally at one another. Caesar attempted to wrestle away, turning his sinewy neck from one to another of them with furious cries like a wild beast. He managed finally to emit a single groan and to muffle his face in the fabric of his robe, precisely as Pompey had done off the coast of Egypt, before sinking to the floor. By the time his assailants rushed to the chamber doors, Caesar lay crumpled on the ground in a soggy purple heap, skewered 23 times, his clothing blood-stained and cut to ribbons. Their togas and senatorial shoes splattered in blood. The murderers fled in different directions, shouting that they had slain a king and tyrant. Terror and confusion swelled in their wake. In the uproar, some assumed the entire Senate to be involved. A crowd that had been transfixed by a holiday gladiatorial contest emptied into the street. Word flew around that gladiators were slaughtering senators. Others believed an army was at hand, prepared to pillage the city. "Run! Bolt doors! Bolt doors!" went the cries, as shutters slammed shut, and Rome retreated behind lock and key, at homes and in workshops. Pandemonium yielded abruptly to paralysis. One minute, the whole place was full of people running and shouting, while the next, the city looked as if it had been occupied by an enemy. In the meeting hall, Caesar's body lay alone and untended for several hours, drenched in blood. No one dared touch it. Only late in the afternoon did three slave boys carry it away, amid hysterical weeping and mourning, from doorways and rooftops. With the possible exception of Calpurnia, to whom the mutilated corpse was delivered, it is unlikely that the news affected anyone as profoundly as Cleopatra. No matter how it registered on a personal level, Caesar's death represented a catastrophic political blow. She had lost her champion. Her situation was now insecure at best. The anxiety was great. Were his friends and relatives also to be murdered? Certainly Mark Antony, by rank the next in command, assumed so. Disguised as a servant, he went into hiding. When he resurfaced, it was with a breastplate under his tunic. Those involved in the attack changed their clothes and vanished, as did their defenders. Cicero approved of the murder, but played no part in it. He fled as well. Given Caesar's anticipated departure, Cleopatra may well have been on the verge of leaving Rome by mid-March. She could by no means have anticipated this finale, however. For years there had been whispers of conspiracies against Caesar, talk that well predated her stay. As for the catalogue of portents, they are impeccable only in retrospect. They might at the time have added up to any number of futures. Ancient history is oddly short on incorrect omens. Only later were the unmistakable signs fitted to the occasion, compiled by men who happened to believe Caesar's murder as much justified as preordained. The explanations similarly piled up later, history being a kind of omen-in-reverse enterprise. As they did so, Cleopatra began to assume a role in the murder. Her presence in Rome demanded an explanation, and it got one. She resolved certain mysteries, corralled the stray motives and rogue details of Caesar's story. There was, for starters, the stubborn problem of the Alexandrian stay. Whether a tribute to Cleopatra's influence or her ambitions, it had to mean something. And what was the significance of her gilded image in the forum at Venus's side? Idle tongues and poison pens were in great supply after March 15th, when there was much accounting to do, when it became more and more clear that Caesar's assassins had no set plan for the future and that Rome had suffered a terrible loss. Significantly, the person most likely to have incriminated Cleopatra does not. She figures nowhere on Cicero's long list of Caesar's missteps and offenses. In addressing a mournful Rome, Cicero invoked the destruction wrought by Helen of Troy, but he was speaking of Antony rather than Cleopatra. Caesar had, over the previous months, evidenced an immoderate taste for extravagant, unprecedented honors. There had been much provocative play-acting with diadems, an accessory from which any good Roman recoiled. Whether this was planned by Caesar or inflicted on him is unclear. It seems the first to offer those honors were also the first to condemn that with each tribute, Caesar's colleagues prepared him for a sort of ambush, because they wished to make him envied and hated as quickly as possible, that he might the sooner perish. Caesar stood supreme, at least in retrospect. It seemed logical that he wanted to be a god in his country, as Cleopatra was a goddess in hers. Soon it was bandied about that a law had been in the works, permitting him to have intercourse with as many women as he pleased. Suetonius cleaned this up, noting that Caesar was to be allowed to marry many wives for the purpose of begetting children. He was to be allowed not only to have several wives, but to wed his foreign mistress, not then possible under the law, which recognized only marriages between Romans. Caesar was said to have intended as well to transfer the capital of the empire to Alexandria. He was intent on taking with him the resources of the state, draining Italy by levies, and leaving the charge of the city to his friends. That account made sense not only of Cleopatra, but of the implicit insult that could be read into her lover's architectural ambitions, his manic refashioning of Rome. The two Caesars, before Egypt and after Spain, were incompatible and incomprehensibly so. Cleopatra supplied a neat dividing line. She could be said to explain his obsession with power and titles in the last 5 months of his life. The royal trappings and divine cravings, the wayward crowns and the oddly autocratic demeanor. By our century, she had come to have conspired in the diadem-distributing charades. She planted the absolutist ideal in Caesar's mind and was poised to become Empress of Rome. She exercised a decisive corrupting influence on the Roman leader, to the extent that a new Caesar was born in Egypt, and to the extent that Cleopatra properly qualified as the founder of the Roman Empire. Certainly, Cleopatra contributed to Caesar's downfall, although there is no evidence of imperial design on her part or on his. No treachery, nor for that matter any blinding fatal passion. How much of a role she played is debatable. For all her persuasive talents, she was unlikely to have been much involved in domestic politics in any meaningful way. Were she and Caesar considering a joint monarchy? Possibly, but no evidence remains. Sometimes a business trip is just a business trip. Suetonius recognized the lot of the unadorned historical account, destined to be improved upon by silly folk who will try to use the curling irons on his narrative. The polymathic Nicolaus of Damascus, who tutored Cleopatra's children, was the first to implicate Cleopatra. A century later, Lucan was happy to follow that lead, neatly rolling her dual offenses against Caesar into a single line. She aroused his greed. Those assertions made for a better narrative than did the plain fact that Caesar had plenty of enemies for plenty of reasons, few of which had anything to do with either Egyptian queens or the Roman constitution. Even the reworking of the calendar had earned him enmity, as he had inadvertently curtailed the appointments of men in power. Those who had reason to be grateful to Caesar resented their debts. Others agonized over wartime losses. Some hoped only to upset the system. And so, conceded one contemporary, every kind of man combined against him, great and small, friend and foe, military and political, every one of whom put forward his own particular pretext for the matter at hand. And as a result of his own complaints, each lent a ready ear to the accusations of the others. On March 17th, Caesar's will was unsealed and read aloud at Mark Antony's home, the large villa that had once been Pompey's, and to which Antony had returned. Although Cleopatra had been in Rome in mid-September when Caesar composed that document, she figured nowhere in it. If she was disappointed, she was not alone. It supported none of the nefarious motives attributed to Caesar. Rather, the will read as one long rebuke to his assassins. He left the villa and grounds on which Cleopatra lived to the people of Rome. He bequeathed 75 drachmas to every adult Roman male in the city. He could not legally bequeath money to a foreigner, and did not. He was hardly as tone-deaf as he had appeared in his last months. He made no provision for or acknowledgement of Caesarion. In a move that startled everyone, he made no provision either for Mark Antony, who had patently expected otherwise. Instead, Caesar named Gaius Octavian, his 18-year-old grand-nephew, as his heir. Formally adopting the boy, he granted him 3/4 of his fortune, and more valuably, his name. Antony was appointed Octavian's guardian, along with several of Caesar's close associates, who happened also to be his assassins. Some believed business in Rome would simply continue as usual after the Ides. They did not count on Antony's gift for spectacle. 3 days later, the city erupted in riots when Caesar's funeral turned into a savage hunt for his murderers. Over the body, laid out with its gaping wounds on an ivory couch, Antony delivered a stirring oration. He was unshaved, a sign of mourning. On the Senate Speaker's platform, he hitched up his robes so as to free both hands. A proud and thunderous expression fixed on his face, Antony chanted Caesar's praises and catalogued his victories. It was at this time that he defended Caesar from charges of having delayed in Egypt out of voluptuousness, effectively alternating his tone from clarion clear to dirge-like. Antony delivered up a potent cocktail of pity and indignation. Never one to resist a flourish, he went on to display Caesar's bloodied gray head. He then, rather unhelpfully, stripped the shredded, blood-stiffened clothes from the body and waved them about on a spear. The crowd went wild, indulging in a spur-of-the-moment cremation and destroying the hall in which Caesar had been killed. A frenzied spree of murder and arson followed, during which, as Cicero had it, almost the whole city was burned down, and once more great numbers were slaughtered. Rome was very much unsafe for Cleopatra, or for that matter, anyone. All the qualities the Romans attributed to the Alexandrians, those fanatical, intemperate, bloodthirsty barbarians, were on vivid display. In the marketplace, a man wrongly understood to be an assassin was torn limb from limb. Cleopatra was fortunate in one respect. Caesar's assailants had repeatedly stalled, for they stood in awe of him, for all their hatred of him, and kept putting the matter off. Had they acted when they originally intended, she might have been forced to remain in agitated Rome. She was in town for the furious thunderstorm that followed the funeral, and to see the comet that streaked through the sky every evening that week. From her villa, she looked out over a city that was generally pitch black at night, but was now dotted with campfires, stoked until dawn, in the name of public order. And then she was gone, her baggage loaded on wagons and conveyed down the winding road of the Janiculum Hill, by way of a series of switchbacks, to the river and toward the coast. The sailing season was newly open. Presumably, with the help of Caesar's adherents, she made a hasty departure. Within a month of the Ides, she was off, her progress carefully tracked by Cicero, her fate much discussed in Rome. The talk died down only in mid-May. Cicero waited a few more weeks, by which time Cleopatra was certain to be back in Alexandria and the coast absolutely clear to vent his disdain. "I detest the queen," he only then exploded, his blood reboiling, without deigning to refer to her by name, a distinction he reserved for enemies and ex-wives. It grated still that he had asked Cleopatra a favor, or that he had compromised himself in doing so, and that he had opened himself to ridicule. Given the turn of events, defaming her suited his purposes as it had not before. Even Cleopatra's representatives felt his wrath, indicted for general rascality and impertinence. How had he exposed himself to such rough treatment from that crew? "They must think I have no spirit, or rather, that I hardly have a spleen," he raged. For Cleopatra, the departure may have been especially fraught. She had made good on her identification with Venus and Isis. In March, she was pregnant again, presumably visibly so, as the secret was out. Cicero had ample reason to follow her closely. A pregnant Cleopatra was the trophy wife who could, at a precarious juncture, complicate Rome's future. Unlike Caesarion, this second child had been conceived on Roman soil. All of Rome knew it to be Caesar's. What if Cleopatra bore a boy and chose to press her case? Cicero may have worried that she could derail the succession. She was perfectly positioned to do so. It was, in any event, to be a season of disappointments for Cleopatra, who either miscarried in the course of her flight home or lost the baby shortly thereafter. In Rome, Cicero breathed a deep sigh of relief. On another level, Cleopatra was richly rewarded. All parties agreed that none of Caesar's regulations, favors, and gifts was to be revoked. Cyprus was secure. Cleopatra would remain a friend and ally of Rome. For its part, that city braced for an orgy of loot, arson, and massacre, as for a likely reprise of the civil war. After the Ides, a lively market opened for defamation and self-justification. There was a run on self-congratulation. Toppling kings was a Roman tradition, too, which the conspirators believed they had valiantly upheld that gray spring morning. Even neutral parties happily contributed to the hostilities. As Dio notes, "There is a very large element which is anxious to see all those who have power at variance with one another, an element which consequently takes delight in their enmity and joins in plots against them." Inculcated from her earliest days with the fear that Rome might dismantle her country, Cleopatra looked on as Rome proceeded instead to demolish itself. It lurched through a dull, damp, dark year, one in which the sun refused to emerge, never showing its ordinary radiance at its rising, and giving but a weak and feeble heat. The reason was probably the eruption of Mount Etna in Sicily, though, the contemporary curling irons at work. Rome preferred the political explanation closer to home. She could only have been pleased to put an ocean between her and the turmoil. Probably she sailed from Puteoli along the Italian coast, through the rough and inhospitable Strait of Messina, to find herself swept across the open Mediterranean in April. The wind was at her back. The southbound crossing was an effortless one. An aggressive captain could make the trip in less than 2 weeks. Within a matter of days, Cleopatra traded the persistent gloom and chilly air of Europe for the opulent warmth of Egypt. In sunny Alexandria, she returned to the grind of public business and private audiences, to a round of rituals and ceremonies. She would never again set foot in Rome, nor would she ever let that city out of her sights. She had played the game cannily and correctly, more effectively than any Ptolemy before her, only to find herself back at square one, blindsided by events, sabotaged by a wholesale revision of the rules. As a near contemporary marveled, who can adequately express his astonishment at the changes of fortune and the mysterious vicissitudes in human affairs? Cleopatra was 26 years old. In a life of barely salvaged, emotionally overblown scenes, the 44 return to Alexandria is the one that got away. Also, the most opera-ready. No librettist has touched it, possibly because there is no text. For a woman who was to be celebrated for her masterly manipulation of Rome, Cleopatra's story would be entrusted primarily to that city's historians. She effectively ceases to exist without a Roman in the room. None stood at hand that spring as she sailed toward the red-tiled rooftops of Alexandria, around the flickering lighthouse.